Happy January, AZ MCasters. Welcome to January's episode of Arizona MCast, where this month, Jared and I have a little sugar for you guys. We're going to have a little acid-based discussion. We're going to talk about management or mismanagement of DKA. And we're also going to have our community panel back again to talk about what they do with their hyperglycemics, assuming they're not having horrible acid-base or DKA problems. Finally, we've got Peter Rosen here again to talk to us about what he thinks of foam in general, as well as peer review and evidence-based medicine. How does this relate into all the podcasts and Twitters and blogs and everything else that everybody's listening to? It should be a good one for the first of the year, short and sweet, so let's get into it. ICU, this is Dr. Mosier.
Hey, this is Aaron Leach down in the ED. I got an ICU admit for you guys.
Oh, yeah? For what?
I honestly don't know. Real sick and needs to go upstairs as soon as you can.
How do you know? What's wrong with him?
Well, I just intubated him.
What did you intubate them for?
Because he was sick, he was having respiratory distress, and was sweaty, and I just intubated. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't change his disposition. He still needs to be an ICU admit.
Well, it'd be nice to know something that's going on with him rather than just he's intubated.
Oh, tell me about it. I'd love to know what's going on with him.
Do you have any other information?
The only thing I have back right now is a blood gas. We got an ABG right after, and he's got a... looks good. pH is 7.4. And PCO2 at 23, PO2 of 148, and a lactate of 5.5. That one's a bit high. Maybe he's septic or something.
Well, that doesn't make any sense. First question is, why did you intubate him?
I intubated him because he was, like, puffing to breathe. I mean, he was just, I mean, really going for it. He looked like he was going to tire out. So we put him down, and we got him on a vent now. He's on AC, tidal volume of 500, rate of 15, PEEP of 5, at 100%.
Well, do you have any other labs?
Hold on, what? Oh, nurse just said calm. His bicarb is 12, but the rest of the labs I think are okay.
12? His bicarb's 12? Is he diabetic?
Why?
Well, it kind of sounds like DKA.
No, he was having respiratory distress. So, what's that medical alert? Diabetes? Yeah, yes, he is diabetic. He's got a medical alert bracelet. Sorry, we didn't see it at first. It was under his clothes. But yeah, he is diabetic. Can we get a sugar? EMS guy? Sure. Okay. 424 was his blood sugar.
Well, it kind of sounds like DKA.
Doesn't look like DKA. He's got a normal pH, so I don't think it's DKA. We're going to scan him for a PE and start him on antibiotics and send him up to you.
All right, I'll come down.
We're getting TPA ready to thrombolyze him. I'm really worried about him.
Oh, my God, don't give TPA. I'll be right there. Well, Happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Jared got a haircut for his birthday.
Yeah, donated the locks.
I'm glad someone is going to be very happy with that hair, I'll tell you what.
And their streaks of gray.
Well, I was going to say that, but your John Stamos mane that you cut off.
Exactly. We're coming to the end of our makeshift studio here. We're going to have a new one soon.
Soon enough. We asked Santa Keim for some recording equipment, and it's coming in little by little. So
I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be great.
It's going to be fantastic.
So... 6 months ago, I sent out a couple acid-base questions, and I've gotten a pretty good response. I think 25 people have responded to me with their solutions to the cases. So I thought maybe we would take one of them and discuss, I don't want to say acid-base, mainly metabolic acidosis. What do you think?
I think that sounds good.
Okay, so the case that I sent out was a 26-year-old type 1 diabetic with headache, vomiting, and diarrhea for a 24-hour period. Okay, so, I mean, if I just say that, what do you think of?
Headache, vomiting, and diarrhea.
Yeah, and a type 1 diabetic.
I'm thinking that this is somebody that may have picked up a bug, but I'm worried about their sugars, and they may or may not be in DKA.
Yeah, I mean, it's DKA until proven otherwise, mm-hmm. right? And that's the emergency that they're going to come in with, is DKA. So I get some labs, and the ABG pH 7.40, PCO2 was 23, PO2 was 148, and lactate was 5.5.
Yeesh.
Okay. The CBC white count was 18.8, hemoglobin was 18, hematocrit was 53, platelets were 122. Okay, metabolic panel, sodium was 132, chloride was 103, potassium was 5, bicarb was 14, BUN was 52, creatinine was 1.5, blood sugar 424, and albumin was 2.6.
All right, I'm going to read those over again about three or four more times just for the sake of boredom.
So the first question I sent out is, what is or are the one or more acid-base abnormalities?
All right, so when I look at this, the first thing I want to know is the pH. So are they acidotic? Are they alkalotic? So this person is 7.4, which is smack in the middle, and that's exactly what I would hope. But just because they're 7.4 doesn't mean that there isn't potentially some competing acid-base disturbances underneath. So the next thing I'm going to look for in the order that you gave the blood gas is the PCO2. So the PCO2 is 23. That's much lower than I would expect with a normal pH. If you're really blowing off that much acid, I would expect you to be far more alkalotic. So then I'm curious what the bicarb is. One of the things that I see people get burned on a fair amount is they look at the gas and they go, oh, no, it's fine, because look, the bicarb is this on the gas. And one of the things that I always make sure they note is that it even says there calculated bicarb. It's not the measured bicarb. So it's calculated based on what everything else is. This is estimated. So until you have a measured bicarb, you can't really say what's going on, but they take their best guess. So the next thing I look at is going to be their bicarb to figure out what their metabolic status is. In this case, this girl has a normal pH, but she's got a low PCO2 and a low bicarb, which means that there's probably some kind of competing and maybe just compensatory alkalosis and acidosis.
Yeah, you've been doing this a long time.
Not that long.
Well, I mean, you've been doing acid-base calculations for a long time. You look at those numbers, it just doesn't look right for it to be one thing, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the kind of the point that I wanted to get across is that don't get lost in the math. That when you look at something, you do this enough on enough patients, and you look at it and you think, that just doesn't add up to be one thing.
Mm-hmm. One of the cases that I have a fair amount is someone who comes in, they're vomiting, they're a type 1 diabetic, they've missed a few doses of their insulin, and their blood gas shows that they're alkalotic. They have a pH of 7.47, and their PCO2 is 15. And their bicarb is low as well. And the question that I usually get is, well, there's no way they could be in DKA because they're not acidotic. What would actually do that? And I said, well, there's a respiratory issue that could do it. And what do they always teach you in physiology about respiratory compensation for a metabolic acidosis? They teach you that you can't overcompensate, right? But people are great at overcompensating or over-exaggerating. So in this case, this diabetic person who has breathed herself down to a pH to a PCO2 in the teens is going, oh my god, I can't be in DKA again. Last time I was in DKA, I was never here. And she's freaking out and hyperventilating. So she had diabetic ketoacidosis, and anxiety was causing a respiratory alkalosis.
Yeah, that was the second question that I had asked in this email was, could this be DKA, why or why not? And I sent that out specifically because, you know, if I give you a pH of 6.8 and a gap of 25 or something, that's pretty obvious, right? But this is a normal pH, 7.40. And I hear two fallacies all the time. One, it can't be DKA because the blood sugar is normal. You know, if you think you're going into DKA and you give yourself a bolus of insulin, your blood sugar could come down. You could have normal blood sugar. It doesn't do anything for the DKA. Number two, it can't be DKA because the pH is normal. And we just described how that's not true, right? For DKA, all you have to have is diabetes and a metabolic acidosis, but not necessarily be acidemic. It just is nice if you are acidemic. So
it's definitely a little bit easier to figure out. So you can have stone cold normal pH, stone cold normal sugars, but there's a few things that you're not going to be able to fake. And one of those things is your bicarb and your GAP.
Correct.
So you can't fake a metabolic, a anion gap metabolic acidosis. If you have that, then you've got something in the mud pile's mnemonic. Even if you've got another primary respiratory alkalosis that's competing against you, say in the case of someone who's freaking out. The ones that I've been burned by in the past is when it's not quite DKA, it's actually something else that will give you a primary respiratory alkalosis as well as a metabolic acidosis, and that's aspirin. So if you get a funky one, this is like the thyroid for me. Of if I don't really know what's going on with acid-base, and I'll throw in an aspirin level. Just like, I don't know what's going on with them, check their thyroid. Thyroid does weird things, so...
Yeah, there are some people that don't have anything in the mud piles. It's just if they have acute renal failure from their whatever their acidosis is, their gap could go up more than you would expect for BUN or lactate or whatever because of hippuric acid and phosphates and sulfates that build up that you don't measure. And then, in those patients, so sometimes I'll send a FOS on them and it'll be 8, 9, something like that. But you know, there are many different ways to attack acid-base. There are three primary ways. The first is the Henderson-Hasselbeck way. And that's the way that we all learn the physiologic approach to acid-base. And just last month, I think I sent this out as an article in the New England Journal of Medicine on the physiologic approach to acid-base management. And it's a fantastic article. The second, and I think that was in a couple weeks later, the New England Journal of Medicine, is the physiochemical approach or the Stewart approach. And then there's the Berlin method, which goes off of the base excess. Now, I think that the physiologic approach is probably the best way to approach it. Why? Because if for nothing else, it's the language that we all speak. If we're in the emergency department and we pick up the phone and we call an intensivist or gastroenterologist or medicine doctor or whatever, and you start talking about the Stewart method or Stewart approach, well, you're going to run into trouble because nobody really uses it. And if you're going to use the Stewart approach, you have to use the whole thing, which is a massive equation, and you have to measure a whole bunch of things. And you can't really start combining things like I know Weingart talks about his method, but that really combines a certain portion of the Stewart method with the Berlin method, and there's no data behind that at all. So I would just try to master the physiologic approach. If you understand the strong ion difference and whatnot, what dissociates in water, that might give you an idea as to why certain fluids that we give make a difference, but for the most part in these patients, the physiologic approach is the way to go. So how do you approach this? Well, first of all, you want to know, are they primarily acidotic or are they primarily acidemic or alkalemic, right? This person has a normal pH, so it's irrelevant. But let's say your pH is 7.2, right? That's a primary acidemia. So they may have an alkalosis as a compensation, but their primary problem is an acidemia. This girl, normal pH, and the bicarb was 14. So you know that this is a primary metabolic acidosis. So your second question is, is there appropriate respiratory compensation? So you do the Winters formula, and you would expect that the PCO2 would be around 26, right?
Mm-hmm. I just did that in my head right now, and yes, that's exactly what I got. Not just kidding.
You would expect that the PCO2 should be around 28 or so, but her measured PCO2 was 23, mm-hmm. So the measured PCO2 is less than the expected, which means, like you said, she's blowing off extra, so she has a secondary respiratory alkalosis. So right there, you know that the primary disorder is a metabolic acidosis, that she has a secondary compensatory respiratory alkalosis. And now you want to know the nature of the metabolic acidosis. Is it gap or non-gap? So you do the gap calculation, and her gap is 15. Which you have to correct for the albumin because that's the primary buffer. So when you correct for the albumin, it's 18. So she has a primary gap acidosis. Now the last question you want to know is that the only thing or is there a secondary metabolic problem? And when you get into the extremes like pH of 6.8 or whatever, anion gap of 30, whatnot, the mathematical model falls apart. And it's also, I mean, it's kind of like in physics, right? And it can't reconcile relativity and quantum mechanics because in the extremes, they each fall apart. It's the same way with acid-base because when you start getting into the extremes, organs start failing, you start having renal failure, you're not perfusing your bone, you get anemic, you can't really buffer your acid-base abnormalities. So they're not going to be perfect in the extremes, but in her situation, the anion gap corrected for albumin, it's 18. So is the change in anion gap the same as the change in bicarb? If they're the same, she just has the primary metabolic gap acidosis. If they're not the same, then she has either a secondary non-gap acidosis or a metabolic alkalosis. So in her case, the change in anion gap was 6. The normal anion gap being 12, her gap was 18, so that's a gain of 6. The change in bicarb, normal bicarb being 24, hers being 14, is 10. So the change in bicarb was greater than the change in anion gap. So she's losing extra bicarb, likely from the diarrhea. So from there, you know she's got a primary anion gap metabolic acidosis, probably from the lactate or the DKA. She's got a secondary respiratory alkalosis, probably from the stimulus to breathe. And she's young and healthy, has good lungs. And then you have the third problem from the diarrhea, which is the non-gap metabolic acidosis.
I love how you talk to me about these things, like quantum physics and stuff, as if I have any idea of what's going on. Let me try to simplify this, and I think that we can have Cliff put this in the notes at the end as well, as far as the order with which you approach this. The first thing that you're looking for is acidemia or alkalemia or a normal pH.
Correct.
So you're going to look at the pH first, and then you're going to look to see, is there a metabolic or respiratory component to this? Which is the primary one? Which is the one that's jumping out the most obvious? Then you're going to be looking at the bicarb to determine if it's a metabolic acidosis. Is this an anion gap or a non-anion gap acidosis? You look at compensation, and then you finally look to see, is there a secondary or even a tertiary competing acidosis or alkalosis to go along with this? And we'll have this spelled out at the end of the notes. But how do you learn something like this? For me, this is the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation is one of those things that makes me itch and start to tweak a little bit, because I hated this in chemistry. But how do you actually learn this? It's like most things. It's repetition. You do lots of problems. You're faced with this, and in this situation, you have to apply it. So what's the best way to go through this is have it written out, like we're going to do at the end that Cliff's going to send out, and just have it nearby so that when you have any acid-base disorder, you do it in this rote way, and eventually it just kind of becomes second nature. And you can look at these and go, oh, I know something is not right with this because I've practiced it over and over and over and over, which is why we are all so good about not giving Dilaudid to people that ask Dilaudid, because we do it over and over and over. So we'll have this spelled out for you, and I would just have it handy so that if you have something on a patient that's any acid-base disorder, just try going through it from start to finish. And when you find that things are normal, great, and you'll probably pick up a few things that are abnormal that may impact the patient's care.
Yeah, and I would say I think that people get most often lost when they start trying to do the compensations, right? Change of 1 per every 10 increase in PCO2. I guess I wouldn't worry about that in most of these patients, right? Like this patient comes in, why would she have baseline acid-base disturbances, right? If somebody comes in with chronic renal failure or COPD, bad emphysema, then I think that you have to start taking into consideration, okay, they probably have chronic acid-base abnormalities, and that's when you start looking at the compensation, right? That's when you start saying, okay, their PCO2 is 105, but their pH is only 7.2. So you have to expect their bicarb is going to be somewhere in the high 30s, high 40s at baseline, which makes their baseline PCO2 probably somewhere in the 70s. So they have an acute respiratory acidosis, and vice versa if you have somebody with renal failure. I think most of your patients are going to be acute problems. Don't get lost in the compensation.
So when you look at your gas as an emergency doctor, there are things that you clearly need to pick up. A pH of less than, if it comes up that the pH is less than or greater than, that's definitely outside of the realm of normal, and you should be able to pick that up. But if you've got a pH that is normal, make sure you look through the rest of the gas to see that everything else looks normal also. Think about your crashing asthmatic that you get a gas on that looks completely normal, even though the patient looks like crap. that doesn't make sense. So what that tells you is that something bad is happening with the patient and they're no longer compensating. Think the same way. In a patient that doesn't look good and has a normal pH, start looking through the rest of those components, the PCO2, the bicarb, the anion gap, to see if there's something else that jumps out at you that can explain why the patient's not doing well. Unfortunately, we had to cut this segment short because Jared received an urgent phone call regarding an admission. This has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that I screwed up the recording.
Yeah, this is Dr. Mosier. I was paged.
Hey, Dr. Mosier. Aaron Leach down in the ER again.
Oh, dear God.
Well, that guy, you were right. His semi-quantitative acetone came back positive, so it was DK. That's crazy.
So
that's
what have you been crazy. Doing for him?
We started an insulin drip on him. And his sugars came down, they were getting down to like 150, so I had to shut off the drip. But sugars are coming back up now, so that's good. But we got another gas after that first one. It's still crazy. It's just he's not acidotic. I can't explain that. But he's acidotic now. His pH was 6.9 this time.
Did you turn the rate up on the ventilator?
I started him on a bicarb drip because he was acidotic. So, and his bicarb was low. It was 12, so I figured he needed some more bicarb. He's bucking the vent. Well, the ICU doc wants to turn. Just give him a dose. Give him 10 of Vecuronium, and he won't buck the vent after that. I guarantee you. Vec always wins. Let me tell you. We just had, he was like kind of fighting the vent, so we gave him some Vecuronium. What do you guys normally like do for sedation for these people? We've got him on some propofol right now, but I think it'll probably just be safest for him when he goes for his PE scan if he's vec'd. So do you guys, is Clint Soup on the line? Anybody going to get this guy a bed sometime soon?
You know, believe it or not, I've heard all of those things.
This is the most fun I've had of making the world's worst admission calls. So DKA is something that we should all know how to manage. And the management for DKA is not insulin. That's the subsequent management once we've got everything else set. The first thing we need to do for these patients, airway, breathing, circulation. So an intubated DKA patient should make everybody worried, just like an intubated asthmatic. So Jared, just kind of highlighting some of the mistakes that we've made just in the last couple minutes that we were talking. So you have a patient that's intubated with DKA, and sometimes they truly do need intubation. The first thing was the sugar goes low.
Yeah.
So when the sugar goes low, we made the sugar low with insulin. So why is it wrong to turn off the drip?
Well, their problem is ketogenesis, not glucose metabolism. So if their sugar goes low, it's just because you've given them insulin, but that doesn't stop the ketogenesis. So this is the reason why I don't ever bolus insulin, because you need to stop. We can get into the enzymes and all that stuff, but I'll spare you the boredom and just say you need to stop the glucagon production, which is mainly the problem as opposed to insulin. So in order to stop the glucagon production, you need a continuous insulin drip. The sugar might drop, and the treatment for that is you just need to give more sugar. Leave the drip alone, 0.1 units per kilo. Leave it alone. Don't touch it until they're ready to transition. I've seen it far too often where the sugar comes down and they cut the drip rate or stop the drip rate. That is absolutely the wrong thing to do. It will prolong their time in DKA. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you know, they need fluid. They're on average 6 to 8 liters dehydrated, depending on how long they've been in it. People who have hyperosmolar, non-ketotic coma, they're 10 to 12 liters dehydrated, so they need fluid. And the third mistake is that people don't recheck the labs. So you need to follow what the blood sugar is doing, and you need to follow what your electrolytes are doing. The people who do follow them, the common mistake is that they transition too early. They get 6 or 8 liters of saline, their chloride goes to 125, and their gaps all of a sudden closed, mm-hmm. quote unquote. It's not really closed. It's just mathematically closed because you've given a bunch of chloride. So you don't want to transition them until their gap is closed and their bicarb is greater than 18. So recheck your labs every couple hours. Once their gap is closed and bicarb is greater than 18, then you can transition them to their sub-Q insulin. 2 hours later, stop the drip. Now, for patients that are intubated, aspirin overdose, DKA, they scare me just as much as asthmatics do. And the reason is that their minute ventilation requirement is sometimes 50 liters a minute or more. And you can't give them that on the ventilator. So when it comes to intubating these patients, you know, I typically don't unless they go apneic or they need it for airway protection. And so if I am going to intubate them, I typically don't paralyze them. I will give them enough sedative to tolerate laryngoscopy. I'll put the tube in and I'll put them on pressure support or PRVC or something and just let them go to town on the ventilator to get what they need. They don't need bicarb. If you have somebody whose pH is 6.8 or whatever, they're not really going to tolerate an apneic period for laryngoscopy. So, you know, maybe a little bolus of bicarb for the intubation is fine.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
But don't ever put them on a bicarb drip because, A, you can't compensate for their minute ventilation requirement. And B, that bicarb that you're going to give them is going to turn into CO2. So you might make their acidosis worse for a period of time. But I think to survive the intubation, it might be okay to give him an amp of bicarb, but nothing after that.
Mm-hmm. One of our peds intensivists, Andy Theodora, likes to say that insulin burns up ketones in the flames of carbohydrates. So you have to have sugar around to burn up to stop the ketosis. And that's the problem, is that they have a ketoacidosis. So it seems a bit counterintuitive, but when you have someone that's come in DKA that said, oh yeah, I saw my sugars were 600, so I bolused myself 10 units of insulin sub-Q, that sub-Q insulin is going to have variable uptake, variable effect, because it's being absorbed subcutaneously, and they may have dumped their sugar and not closed their gap. So you never shut off the drip. I have had patients with central lines in receiving D25 IV to keep their sugars up to close their gap. But if they get low, usually somewhere around 200, 250, you just start some sugar on them with the drip on, and then you titrate the sugar up as needed or down as needed to try to keep them in a good state.
Correct.
The other thing, and this is from the pediatrics perspective, I'm with Jared, I don't bolus insulin. You can make the numbers look pretty, but you can also falsely reassure yourself that the physiology is also that pretty. Even if the mathematical number is okay, they may physiologically still be in ketoacidosis. I think DKA is something that evolves over time, and it's not something that should be fixed over a matter of minutes. If it evolved over the course of several days, it may take at least several hours to fix and not necessarily days. From the pediatric perspective, we never give bicarb. It's one of the independent risk factors for cerebral edema and death from DKA. Boluses of insulin and large volume fluids have also been associated but aren't definitely independent risk factors. So for kids, I always tote the pediatric perspective. Just take your time, let it go slow. Most of you have seen my video of the DKA kid that looks like he's near death, but we didn't intubate him and he ended up doing fine.
Yeah, I mean, so if the pH is 6.9, you just gotta ride it out and let the insulin do the work. There's nothing you can do about it.
So let's talk about the vent settings and the other mistake that we made as far as giving this guy some vecuronium to make sure he sat still for the scanner. So you're trying to match what this guy was doing ahead of time. This is probably what freaks you out when the RT turns to you and says, Dr. Mosier, what vent settings do you want for this guy that was breathing 60 times a minute?
Yeah, you think, you know, his PCO2 pre-intubation was 23. So you know that he is really blowing hard to try to get his metabolic acidosis compensated for. And of course he's unable to do that because he's still producing a bunch of keto acids. So let's say he's breathing 50, 60 times a minute, and he's Kuzma breathing, and he's taking a liter each of those times. That's 50 or 60 liters per minute of minute ventilation. Now, you intubate him, and you put him on a rate of 15 with a tidal volume of 500, and what's that, 30 liters per minute? So you have now effectively cut his minute ventilation in half. But he still wants that because he's still in DKA, so he's going to be fighting the ventilator. And then you say, oh, he's fighting the ventilator, patient ventilator desynchrony, we're going to give vecuronium so that we don't get ventilator-induced lung injury. You know, that's probably the wrong thing to do in a patient like him because your pH is going to plummet. You know, I've seen people who have a pH of 6.9 when you pre-intubation, and just for the period of apnea during intubation, it's gone down to 6.5 just for that 15 seconds. So they are rapidly producing ketoacids. So for that time period, you know, maybe a little bicarb's okay, but you need to keep their minute ventilation up. I saw Raj Joshi put somebody on the ventilator with a rate of 55 the other day, and I about had a stroke, but it was okay.
It was the right choice.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't even know the ventilators can go that fast, but good for you, Raj.
Yeah.
The last thing that was a mistake I couldn't figure out how to work into this vignette, but remember that your DKA patients are total body potassium depleted. They are not only diuresing from their hyperosmolality and peeing all of their potassium out, but their acidosis is causing a shift intracellularly so that all of their intracellular potassium is being shifted out and then peed out. So a person whose serum potassium is elevated still is deficient in potassium. They're still losing it. A person with a potassium that is normal is pretty low, and a person with a potassium that registers as low is very low. So what's one of the things that we do for hyperkalemia is we give insulin. So we're treating this diabetic with insulin to try to close their gap, but if their potassium comes back low, especially like in the twos, 2.8, 2.9, you know, maybe even lower, the last thing that person needs is insulin. Hyperkalemia is treated pretty easily with insulin, so if their K comes back at 7, great, get the insulin going. But if their K comes back low and you give them insulin to make it go lower, there is no tougher arrest to treat than hypokalemia. What are you going to do, IV push potassium on them? So make sure if you have a low potassium that you try to replace it somehow before you actually start the insulin. You got a little bit of time with most of these people, so you can wait until their VBG comes back in 10 minutes and shows an estimated whole blood potassium before you decide to hang the drip, because they're going to be on that drip for quite a while.
Yeah, and you're going to have to replace it orally and IV. If you have to replace it fast enough. You know, the other thing is they're total body phosphate depleted, and you have to have phosphate around to make ATP. So that's another thing to check and replete as necessary.
Yeah. The one thing I forgot to mention on this patient is I started tube feeds as well because I was waiting so long for an ICU bed. So thanks, Jared.
Touché.
We hope you've enjoyed this segment and that you've learned quite a bit about what not to do when you have a sick DKA patient. Keep in mind, recognition is everything, so you have to recognize what's going on before you can start treating it. Once you start treatment, be aware of those pitfalls that we discussed earlier about sick DKA patients. As a recap, remember that ABCs comes before I and insulin is at the end. Remember that intubating a DKA patient is not something you should take lightly, and you should heavily consider everything before you do so. Remember that you can still be in DKA even if your pH appears normal or even alkalemic, and whatever you do, do not shut off the drip. If you turn off the insulin drip, you're going to have to start all over. Moving on from the critically ill to the chronically ill, we're bringing back some of our community physicians to ask them what they do about their hyperglycemic patients. As a quick recap, this is Arthur Smolensky, Emily Osborne, Chris Graham, Brooke Rozonke, and Nate Arnone, who practice all over the country, but all share that they are graduates of our program. So we ask them, what do you do about the diabetic patient that comes in and has a sugar that's elevated? Not critically high, but high, not normal. Something like 300. Remember that this segment is almost purely opinion, but these are the opinions of tried and true emergency doctors that are very smart and have been doing this for a while. So take it with a grain of salt, but see if you can apply this into your patient population and go out on your own.
It comes back 300. What's a number that you decide you're going to chase? Do you decide at 300, I'm just going to load you up with some fluids and send you home? Do you decide I'm just not going to address it? You're diabetic, so don't worry about it.
That would be it.
What was that?
300 might get some fluids.
IV fluids?
Take
I think you got to look at whatever their baseline is, and they're coming to the ER for a possible emergency of some kind.
Let's say they're
send them out. You want to make sure that they're well enough to go out. So if that means they live at 400, mm-hmm. I'm going to send them out at 400.
Okay.
If they live at 200, I'm going to send them out at 200. You know.
Right. So if they roll their ankle and they check their sugar and it's 450, and they don't look bad, they're not Kussmauling.
If they tell me they never take their metformin, glipiride, they never check their sugar, and I look at their last labs and it was 400 that time too, I wouldn't chase it at all.
You have to look at, are you actually going to do something about it too, other than just give them fluids? Because if you give them fluids or give them a little regular insulin, you're going to fix their blood sugar for the next 6 to 12 hours.
They'll see it again.
Yeah, but then right after that, it's going to be back up to 400. So unless you're doing something for them beyond that, you're effectively fixing them for 6 to 12 hours.
I think I sort of disagree. So I think it gets to the buffing of the chart. So like to me, I would, you know, if it was, if there's a number, I mean, that's just what it is. You're buffing the chart. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, if they're, let's say it's 600. I mean, I wouldn't discharge somebody with blood glucose at 600. The reality is that number doesn't mean anything without everything else. So for somebody like that, I would draw basically the equivalent of a BMP, do an ISTAT. I would give them IV insulin. I'd give them fluid. I'd recheck their sugar 1 to 2 hours. It would be a better number. Probably I would discharge somebody with under 400. That's just kind of my comfort level of where I work. But that's what I would do. But if they had any other complaint, even kind of vague stuff, abdominal pain or anything like that, then I think it makes it a little bit different. But if it really is like a rolled ankle, you know, playing basketball.
You're getting into more of the medical legal aspect of things. Are you really doing anything for the patient there? No. Are you doing something for yourself? Yes.
You can't fix people that don't want to be fixed.
Right. I mean, you're making yourself feel better. You're making the chart look better. But
there's something to be said
for that. And there's absolutely something to be said for that.
And that patient should have a say in this, too. I mean, it's totally reasonable to offer them, you came here for a sprained ankle.
Right.
A triage checked your sugar. Do you want us to follow this up? We could do labs and see if you have an gap. We could do these things to see if there's an underlying infection. Is that what you want? Is that what you came here for? Or do you want me to just address your ankle? And if the answer is, I just want you to address my ankle and I'll get back on my sugars or I'll follow up with my doctor, let the patients have some say in their care.
So I think there's a lot of different considerations you could have when treating these patients. I think the one that Emily brings up is certainly the most important, which is what's going to be best for the patient. What are their needs? What is their comfort level? What is their understanding? Spend a couple minutes and talk to them and figure out, do they have time restrictions? Do they have knowledge gaps? Do they have something else and maybe don't even realize this is abnormal? Or could this be the sign of something bad for them? Normally they run in the 120s and have perfect glycemic control, and all of a sudden they're crazy out of control in the 300s, and they don't know that. So this can be something very important to discuss with the patient, and you have to determine what's going to be best for them, what's going to be best for you, and what's going to be best in the long run for the system. Well, we've reached the end of this month's episode of AZMcast. It was kind of a quick one, but we're almost to the point of where Brian takes the stage and tells us everything that we screwed up on. However, before Brian steps in, we wanted to give him a tough act to follow. So we asked Peter Rosen about his opinions of free open access medicine and how that relates to evidence-based medicine and published journals. We started doing the peer review earlier this year, and I think it's been great to have Brian come in and try to help keep us balanced on what we say. But what does the peer review actually add? Is the peer review for foam or podcasts or social media the same as doing a peer review for a journal article? Is it just as valid? Is it less valid? Is it more valid? These are some of the things I wanted to get from Dr. Rosen. So, you've seen medical education change over the years. The internet has allowed for wide exchange of ideas, though these ideas can oftentimes be opinion or experience that is not necessarily rooted in scientific evidence. We have a peer review on our program, as weak as it may be, sorry Brian, to help keep Jared and I in check.
How much does the peer review add to the validity of an opinion?
Was to try to get away from expert-based medicine. Because experience is useful. There's no question that you modify your practice on the basis of what you've been doing for many years and the bad experiences that you have that force you to change. But you can't learn just from opinion. Now, that's not to say that just because something is published, it makes it valid evidence. And that's one of the things that we strive for in this and most other residencies, is to teach you how to think critically about the articles that you read. But I do think you have to use both. Podcasts and people's opinions are nice because they're easy. They're fun to listen to, and they do the work for you. They review the literature for you. They give you their experience, and it's nice to have someone give you an immediate answer to a problem. But it may not be the correct answer. And so you have to do some of the work yourself. And not all the literature is great, but you know as well as I do, there are classic articles, and there are articles that are sort of the big buzz article at the moment that's going to alter practice or give people a reason to further that practice. And I think you need to look and see what that literature is based on. I remember the time I discovered that aminophylline, a drug we used to use all the time for asthma, was given in a very rigid fashion. A loading dose of 5 milligrams per kilogram and then a maintenance dose of 1.2 milligrams per kilogram per hour. And I finally looked up the literature on where that came from, and it came from a prospective study published in the New England Journal that had a total of 7 patients. Now, if that isn't a type 2 error, I don't think I've ever seen one. And yet we treated millions of patients with that dosage schedule, religiously adhered to because the New England Journal said that that was the way to do it. I think you got to use your brain as well as your own experience. And the problem with learning from just reading a single article or just listening to a single podcast or just using a single textbook is that you haven't processed the material. You can't check everything you do. First of all, not everything we do has evidence to support it. But you can certainly think about why we do it, and if you're puzzled as to the need for it, then go back and see what the evidence is. And if it doesn't exist, either that gives you a research project to do, or you can stop doing it. A patient comes in with what sounds like ischemic chest pain, and they tell you that they've had a stress test. And you say, when was the stress test? And they say, last week. And you say, what did it show? And they say, it was negative. Now, what's the value of that as evidence? And the answer is zero. And the reason it's zero is, number one, just because a stress test was negative doesn't mean it can't turn positive pretty quickly. And secondly, you don't know what negative means. It means different things to different cardiologists, depending on what protocol was used. The patient may not have been able to exercise sufficiently because of a leg arthritis, and they may have meant that it was negative in that it didn't show anything positive, but it was an incomplete test. And so you have to really understand what is the value of your evidence before you rely on it.
Well, Brian, you're up.
Just talking loud, then say nothing, just say nothing.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian back here for a little peer review at the request of Aaron and Jared, since they need to be kept in check sometimes. So this month, the focus was on acid-base, and then really with an example of DKA, referring back to acid-base. So for me, acid-base is trying to decide when I want to apply this. I think most patients have an acid-base disorder, but their body's going to correct it and they're going to go on and do fine without any intervention that you may have. So when you're thinking about acid-based disorders, you have to decide when you're going to actually look for them. Maybe it's someone you think has DKA. Maybe it's someone you think has a toxic alcohol or a salicylate poisoning, or the clinical picture just doesn't make sense. We commonly see COPD patients that have an acid-base disorder chronically and then acutely, but we don't look for acid-base disorders or try to solve if their respiratory compensation is equaling their metabolic compensation. That just hurts my brain way too much. So if you're looking for an acid-base condition, the first question you should ask yourself, as Jared said, is the patient primarily acidemic or alkalotic? The second question I ask myself then is, are their bellows working? So are their lungs working to compensate, yes or no? And then is that sufficient? The third thing I'll look at is the bicarb, seeing if it's up, down, or normal. And then the deeper thought I would have would be, does the patient require an osmolarity? Or they have a mixed picture? Is this a toxic alcohol, aspirin, some kind of shunt physiology in the lung? And really get into the nitty-gritty of a mixed acid-base picture. But for most of these patients, you're going to look at the patient and be worried about a clinical condition, and then you're going to order a venous gas and check their bicarb and see if that is confirming the clinical condition that you think the patient has. If it does, you know the acid-base disorder and you've already worked through that. You don't need to do tons of calculations at that time. The times when the labs don't match what the patient looked like, or the labs are demonstrating an undiagnosed acid-base condition, that's when I start to try to really figure out, is this my mud piles pneumonic or something else I need to apply? Aaron and Jared did a good job of discussing acid-base, and they attached a New England Journal article that does a nice job of explaining things almost as well as Jared did, but the article and their explanations almost made me think of a love child between calculus and organic chemistry. Ooh, boy, I love numbers and ions. So anyway, acid-base, think about it. If a patient's really sick, are they acidemic or alkalotic? Is their respiratory compensation appropriate? Is their bicarb high, low, or normal? And then if you really have to think, start thinking about mixed pictures and osms, and that's when you break out your Google and your calculators. The next topic was on diabetic ketoacidosis, now going on a acid-base problem with a mixed picture. DKA, I think, is a great disease for emergency medicine. We can make people better faster, and there's a lot of good thinking involved. To me, I simplify it to basically you have a patient that looks like a raisin, and you want to make them back into a grape. So how do I do this? Well, my tenets for DKA treatment are IV fluid bolus. I do address the ABCs, like Aaron says. And A, I ignore their airway. B, I make sure that they are still breathing. And C, I work on fluid resuscitation. I agreed with Jared, you do not want to intubate anyone with DKA. So once you've identified a diabetic ketoacidosis patient, you make sure they're not apneic. If they're apneic, they get a tube. If they're not, let them breathe. Their bellows are better than any vent. Those points were well stated. And this is not a time for a GCS of less than 8. Their GCS can be 3, 4, 5. If they're handling their secretions and they're breathing appropriately, let them be. And let their metabolic condition get better with your treatments and some time. So, since I focus on C, the first thing is that normal saline 30 cc per kilo bolus. I give this to everybody, kids and adult. I try to treat everyone as a big kid with weight-based dosing. So the adults usually get 2 liters, and the kids will get 30 cc's. After my first bolus, I give them a second bolus. The second bolus is, in a sense, an elevated maintenance for these patients. So I don't like writing maintenance doses because if I write that order, someone's going to have to stop that order. However, if I write a bolus of 1 liter over 4 hours, that's the equivalent of a 250 cc maintenance rate or twice maintenance rate in that patient for 4 hours. But it has an expiration date, and time 4 hours after I start it, so I won't continue to give them fluids when they don't need it. So my second bolus may be a liter over 2 hours, a liter over 3 hours, a liter over 4 hours, depending on how the patient looks and how I feel they can respond with their fluid deficit that they have. The third thing that I look to do in these patients is replace their potassium. If you've identified the patient with DKA, I think the next thing that's easy to do, and I have no data to back this up, is to start a 10 milliequivalent K-Rider. And you're going to run that over an hour. So by the time you start it, we know their total body down, unless their K is 7, and they are going into ectopy on their EKG and having signs of hyperkalemia, you can start that initial 10 rider. You know they're going to get multiple 10 milliequivalent doses, so why not start the first one now? I agree with Aaron, you don't want to start insulin if their K is 2, but assuming their K is high, which it usually is, it's usually between 4 and 6, you will start them on some insulin. So I'm starting potassium and insulin at the same time. And I agree, no bolus on your insulin, just start it. Your insulin is going to take time for someone to make up that drip by the time you order it. It's also going to take time as soon as you start that drip, maybe they weigh 80 kilos. So it's going to take an hour before 8 units of insulin are on board. As opposed to sometimes with people with asymptomatic hyperglycemia, you'll see people bolus 10 units of regular insulin IV. So just think about the rapid effects of that. You giving 8 units over an hour is going to take time to have an effect. So it's okay to start the insulin early. It's okay to start the potassium early, and you're doing that with the fluids. If you're wrong on one of those drips and you miss something, you can always turn them off. If you're like, oh, it's not DKA, it's something else, it's salicylate poisoning and I'm screwing them up, then you can stop those drips and you're not going to have given a large amount of insulin that will throw the patient out of whack. I also will then start to order my follow-up labs. My follow-up labs will be a glucose every hour and a venous gas and electrolyte panel every 1 to 2 hours, depending on how sick the patient is and how long I've had them in my emergency room. Know that on your first gas, you may have a pH that looks nasty. Maybe it's 7, maybe it's 6, 9. Your second gas will probably look worse. You've now started to hydrate the raisins. The raisins are now going to drop some more acid in the bloodstream and it'll be measured on your first and second venous blood gases. So just know that your gases may get worse before they get better. This is not the reason to reach for the bicarb or the bicarb drip, as Aaron and Jared pointed out. I see this with the medical residents all the time in the ICU, as well as when they come and try to treat my patients, or I shouldn't say treat them, try to kill them while they're still in the ER before they take them to the intensive care unit. And I tell them, no, that is bad. Giving them more bicarb just means they're going to have more carbon dioxide to blow off. But they say, oh, the numbers are so bad, doctor. Yes, they're bad. That's why we're treating them and we're trying to get them better. So be patient with these patients. Ha ha. Let them correct this metabolic derangement by themselves. You're assisting them by hydrating them. You're repleting their potassium, you're repleting their water stores, repleting their insulin that they need, and eventually you'll be repleting their glucose. So the last thing I look for is to start to give them glucose. And if someone is awake, maybe their pH is 7.15, they don't look too bad, they're breathing a little fast, but they're awake, I'm okay feeding these patients if their mental status works. They are going to need more sugar. They are going to have insulin that's putting sugar in their cells. So as the raisins become grapes, they're getting fluid, but they're also needing sugar. So it's okay to feed them if their mental status allows for it. If someone's gorked and just breathing like a bellows, no, I do not feed them. But if their sugar's dropping less than 250, you do want to start to add some glucose to their fluids. Now, you can bolus if you need to resuscitate. You can bolus someone D5 normal saline. You've seen me do this many times on nausea vomiting patients. That's one way. And as Aaron said, you can get up to a D25 drip if you need to. and start infusing sugar back into their body so their sugars don't drop, but don't stop the insulin drip. So that's kind of my DKA practice. Fluids number one with a bolus, fluids with a longer bolus over a longer period of time, insulin, no bolus, just the drip, potassium, start it early, start IV, and also give them oral potassium if they can tolerate. Glucose, once they are less than 250 or if they're awake, I let them eat. Then I check a glucose every hour. Venous gas and electrolytes every hour. Knowing that the pH is probably going to go down, I'm not going to add a bicarb drip. I'm not going to intubate these patients unless they're dead. And if I have to intubate, I do agree with Jared's point. Maybe that's the time to push an amp of bicarb to buy you that short period so they don't really bottom out and go into a PEA arrest from acidosis. Some other points I do need to call Aaron out on. He was talking about cerebral edema in DKA patients and kids. And he was talking about an association of bolusing fluids to these kids is going to make them have cerebral edema.
Large volume fluids have also been associated, but aren't definitely independent risk factors.
He didn't say make them have, but he said associated with. And that's just wrong. You're wrong, Aaron. Wrong, 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 wrong. What this is, I'm just messing with you, Aaron. So he attached a paper to me, which actually, the paper he gave me to look at actually contradicted the statement that he made with the association of IV fluid rates. Cerebral edema is a bad thing that happens more commonly in kids, more commonly in younger kids, more commonly in sicker kids. So the ones that get cerebral edema are the sickest kids. It's not that you've treated them with fluids. It's not something you've done. It's just the sicker the disease process is in those kids, they're going to do worse, right? We know this. Patients who are worse do worse. So if the patient has a lower bicarb and is having problems compensating and is having problems with their dehydration and metabolic derangement, they're more likely to go into cerebral edema. Yeah, it may only be 1% of kids, but this does not mean you don't stop your fluid resuscitation on these patients. So I still bolus 30 cc per kilo and then start them on a rapid hydration protocol. So that was my biggest check on you on this time, Aaron. Thank you for proving the point with the paper. I really appreciate it.
Now, normally I let Brian go on his merry way and let him think that he's very important and says things that are meaningful. However, I take offense to this and I'm going to rebut your rebuttal.
You're at Quincy's. Any Quincy's. You're at Quincy's. No, any Quincy's. No starches.
You can't do that.
Can do.
Cannot.
Stamped it.
Can do. Double stamped it. No erases.
Cannot.
Triple stamped it. No erases.
Tell Blue make it through.
You can't triple stamp a double stamp. You can't triple stamp a double stamp, Lord.
I will agree that the paper did not show a statistically significant linkage between rate of fluid administration and cerebral edema. However, it also did not show a negative correlation, meaning fluids aren't necessarily harmless. So since there's really not a statistic that we can pull out of this paper, what I'm going to ask you, Brian, is what's your hurry? You think that your 30 per kilo bolus is going to get this kid out of the ICU faster? No. So take your time. This is something that's happened over time, so why rush it? You're not going to get this kid out of the unit a minute faster by pushing fluids in and messing with the kid's osmolality. I am all for a rapid resuscitation of maintenance fluids, say twice maintenance fluids. I think that's great. But giant boluses that make the kid's eyes pop out and his back teeth float is not what you should be aiming for, especially in the sick DKA patients, which are the ones that you are the most concerned about. So if your N of 61 is enough for you to hang your hat on, have fun with it, man. All I'm saying is take it slow. I also will take issue with letting kids who are in DKA eat. Kids are always thinking hamburgers in the back of their mind. If you've got a kid with DKA, you've got much more sensitive fluid shifts. Please don't feed them or else you will have a very angry intensivist on the other line.
The next discussion point was, what do you do for an asymptomatic hyperglycemic patient in your ED? My answer for this is, if I'm not putting an IV in the patient, I probably do nothing other than counseling. if I'm putting an IV in the patient, then I'll probably give them some fluids, and I rarely give insulin. But this question is very dependable. There are so many variabilities, I think, in these patients that they're presenting with. If they're sick, not sick, if they're sicker, you're probably going to do more. If their chief complaint is more minor, you're probably going to do less with the sugar. If you're putting an IV and treating them for a while, you may do more with the sugar. You may add more lab tests to evaluate if the patient's in diabetic ketoacidosis or HNK. So if they're coming in with a nothing burger complaint, I have a hangnail. It hurts. My sugar was 350 in triage. Does anything else bother you? No. Treat the hangnail and send them home. If they're coming in with some headache and maybe even some flu-like symptoms and their sugar is 400, yeah, probably give them some few liters of saline. Check a sugar. Make sure it's coming down. Make sure they're not in DKA. Maybe you ordered a pH. Maybe you ordered a bicarb. That's okay. Now, since I'm feeling a little froggy, I think I'm going to do a little review of Dr. Rosen. Why? Because Aaron gave me a mic and let me talk. So, actually, I don't have much bad to say about Dr. Rosen. I do agree that podcasts and textbooks and articles are all different learning elements. They should be applied, like any technology, with suspicion, and they all should be applied with skepticism. You have to decide what you truly believe in and what you think makes sense and what the evidence shows and what you think is applicable for your patients. So to me, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I take those podcasts with what I've learned in med school, with what I've learned in textbooks, with what I've learned in articles, and I filter all that in the blender of my mind, and then I decide what of it is true and how can I use it to impact my patients. So I think you should be skeptical on everything that someone says or you read in a journal or you read in a textbook. But to me, your medical school knowledge is kind of like the floor of a house. Your residency is the structure, the framework, the plumbing. And when you start talking about articles and podcasts, you know, that's painting on the wall. That's maybe a new ceiling fan or light fixture. That's finesse stuff. That is not the core knowledge that you want to have as a physician going forward. But you have to be able to redecorate your house when new things come along. So I think you probably should not listen to anything I say, as most of it is nonsense and rambling. But you should understand that these are educational tools that are expressing opinions or practice patterns that allows us to see there is more than one way to practice the way we do. Variability in our practices is ginormous and probably an issue in emergency medicine that needs to be reined in to a degree, but it's hard to get variability out of doctors' practice. So use the podcasts, use the text, use the articles that you think answer the questions that you are commonly facing with your patients, and you are trying to apply as best an evidence-based reasonable approach to your patients without harming them and alleviating their suffering. So if you do that, you're probably okay. All right. That's all I got. Nice acid bass, because it's all about the bass. No treble. It's all about the bass, about the bass, about the bass. No treble. All about the bass, Aaron. I like your bass. Talk to you guys next month. Bye.
Much like Brian, I am also out. We hope you guys have a happy new year. We'll be coming back with board review in February, and we're going to have February's episode out early for all of you that are studying for the in-service exam. We apologize to those of you that are pharmacists, nurses, paramedics who have to listen to our boring board review stuff. However, we are trying to placate the people that listen to us most. So get some other people, and we'll leave the residents out of it. No, I'm just teasing, guys. We will have our new studio, so I'm hoping things sound a whole lot better. And we hope you enjoy and have a wonderful time doing your important job in the emergency department. Until then, bye for now.